And we continue today with our series of interviews conducted at the Kivira Coalition Conference in November of this year. I'm delighted to welcome to the Radio Cafe Dr. Christine Jones. She's a research scientist in soil biology and ecology. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Mary Charlotte, and I'm really, really excited to be here to talk to your listeners today.
Now, you research and write about and teach about the immense advantages of growing food from living soil. First of all, what does that mean? In what ways is soil alive or dead?
Well, soil in its natural state, like in a healthy state, is an incredible ecosystem. I mean, some people have drawn parallels between, you know, what we see when we look up into the sky at night. We see all those millions and trillions of stars that are up there. It's just like we're standing on the ceiling of this almost unknown universe in the soil, because most of the life on land, believe it or not, is in the soil. What we see above the soil, the plants and the animals that we see, is a tiny, tiny fraction of what is in soil. We know very little about it because it's, you know, mostly invisible. You have to have a microscope to be able to see it. And a lot of the things that live in soil just refuse to be cultured in a laboratory, so we can't really study them. And humans being humans, you know, unless something's really easy to see and easy to understand, we tend to ignore it. But we're finding that the life in the soil, the quality of the life in the soil, the abundance of it, the diversity of it, is just like super, super important for the health of, well, for our well-being and for the health of everything else that lives on this planet. As time goes by, we realise that, like, our gut microbiome is very important to our health, like the microbes that live in our gut, and you can have a healthy gut microbiome or an unhealthy one. And we're realising that the health of the soil and the productivity of the soil in terms of what it can produce and the quality of the food that it can produce is dependent on how much life is there and how much diversity is there. So in terms of the soil being dead, you know, it's probably, that's probably a fairly emotive term, I suppose, when we say dead, because it's never really like totally dead, but we get it being certainly a lot less life, a lot less vibrant than it could be by using chemicals that will definitely have a huge impact on a lot of the beneficial microbes that are there, or not nurturing it in ways that support the life that's there. So it's not never completely dead, fortunately for us, but we can certainly have a lot more vibrancy in our soils than we currently do in many of our food production areas.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, when you grow crops, when you grow food, whether it be vegetables or fruits or whatever, in healthy living soil, as you say, there's so many countless species that we barely know even what they are, have names for all of them, living under the ground. They contribute in lots of different ways to the food that we eventually eat. What are some of those ways? Like, when I was listening to you speak about this, it felt almost like communities of little people, little workers underground.
Yeah, well, that's a great description for it, because I often refer to the fact that soil is a village. In order for a village to function effectively, you know, you need a post office and a bank and a school and a grocery store and a gas station and all those kinds of things that, you know, to be an effective functioning community. When we start taking out key functions, we take out the grocery store, there's not going to be food anymore. You take out the gas station, there's not going to be gas anymore. You take out the post office, you can't, you know, post your letters, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And unfortunately, a lot of the chemicals that we use in agriculture kill out key functional groups of microbes. And then when the soil doesn't function effectively, I mean, all the minerals that our plants need are in the soil, but plants themselves can't obtain those things. We need the microbes to obtain the minerals to make them available to plants. And in order to do that, the microbes need energy, and they obtain their energy from plants. We need lots of different kinds of plants above the surface of the soil, with lots of different kinds of roots in the soil, exuding different substances that support different kinds of microbes. I know it sounds all a bit complex, but in fact, nature works with complexity. That's how it functions, in order to obtain all the different minerals that, at the end of the day, that we need to have in our diet for us to be healthy. I mean, we are suffering. A lot of people these days do suffer from malnourishment. They say, you know, some people say that the current epidemic, if you like, of obesity is because people are malnourished, so they're starving. You know, so they're overweight but undernourished, and they're always looking for food because of the fact that the food they're eating really doesn't have anything in it. So if we have soil that doesn't really have the microbes in it that it needs, then our food can't possibly have the trace elements and minerals in it that it needs.
And that was really a revelation for me. I mean, you might eat a head of lettuce, you might eat a salad or spinach or radishes or something like that, and there can be a radical difference in how much nutrition it has depending on whether it was grown in living soil or in chemically treated soil. And what that means is that, I mean, when the little microbes aren't there, they're like the little miners who take the minerals out of the soil and bring it into the plant. And if they're not busy doing that, then you've got a piece of lettuce that, I mean, we've been told to eat our salad, but not all salads alike. Some of the salad doesn't have very good nutrition.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. And I love the analogy of the microbes being like the little miners, you know, going out to fetch the minerals, because, I mean, you could be standing on top of ground that was like, you know, it was a gold mine basically, but unless you had some way of accessing that gold, you need some equipment to dig a hole and something else to bring it back to a processing area, and you need to process it using certain other substances, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, all those things are going on in the soil all the time, all the communication, the collection of the minerals, the moving of the minerals, the processing of them and putting them into plant available forms, just so that, I mean, at the end of the day, that those things will be in our food. One of the issues we have, like the lettuce is a classic example, is that if the soil doesn't have the life in it that it needs, people growing lettuces tend to think, oh, well, the lettuce won't grow, right, unless you've got the living soil, so we'll put some nitrogen on it to make it grow. And then, unfortunately, if you put nitrogen on things like lettuce, they become very high in nitrates, which are actually quite carcinogenic at high levels. It's not just so-called poisons that we put on food. Nitrate is carcinogenic, and then any excess that runs off where you're growing the lettuces will get into the rivers and streams, get into the groundwater, and a lot of the groundwater in the United States is poisoned with nitrate. Huge amounts. In fact, probably nearly all of your groundwater that's in agricultural areas has been, unfortunately, poisoned with nitrates to the point where it's unsafe for humans to drink.
Another piece that's also scary and interesting at the same time is when you don't have these microbes in the soil that deliver minerals to, let's say, the lettuce, then the lettuce becomes weaker because those minerals give it an immune system. When it doesn't have the immune system, it's more vulnerable to pests, and then you get pesticides.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a sort of one of those things. It's like the domino effect. If the soil isn't alive and you need to apply some fertilizer just to make something to grow, and then the plant is weakened by that, and it still doesn't have the minerals in it that it needs, because nitrogen obviously isn't going to fill the place of copper, cobalt, zinc, calcium, magnesium, sulfur, boron, you know, there's a whole list of things that plants need to have. And then if they don't have those elements in them, they don't have an effective immune system. So insects come along or fungal pathogen comes along. And in order to save that crop, the farmer will then need to use a fungicide or an insecticide so that we get all those poisons on our food as well. And if only people could realise that it's all about the soil, it's all about life in the soil, it's all about diversity, you know, diversity of plants above ground, diversity of microbial communities below ground, and getting those minerals and trace elements into our plants, there would be no need to use any of the toxic substances that are applied to food.
You work with people to make a transition from land that has been degraded, for example, through chemical fertilizers, herbicides, pesticides, things like that, all of which kill those wonderful little microbes in the soil, to the point where they're really not active in the food that we eat, as we've just talked about. When you go through that process of restoring a piece of land, like somebody calls you to consult, what do you do first? What is that process like? How long does it take? What does it look like?
Well, I guess the first thing is is going to have a look and see what's happening there. It, you know, that makes a big difference just looking at something. And I mean, there are certain key things that are usually missing. And the thing that we find that is missing the most is diversity. So if you're just growing, like if you just have lettuces, well, what sort of life in the soil are lettuces going to support? When you consider that the ground that those lettuces have been growing on, if you went back 100 years or 200 years to whatever was growing there before, it would have been a diverse plant community of some kind. So we're seeing and recognising more and more that diversity is the key thing that's missing in many places, and that once you get diversity there, reinstate diversity, you actually don't need to use any chemicals at all. It's just amazing. The power of diversity just blows me away.
So let's say somebody has a lettuce farm. They've got some number of acres and they've been trying to grow lettuce, and their lettuce is getting weaker and weaker, and they've got more and more pests and they're spraying more things and it's just gone downhill. And then they call Christine Jones. So you come in and say, well, we need diversity. Like, what would you have them plant?
Well, it would depend where they grow or where they live and what would actually grow in that climate, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, there's just a whole lot of different things that could be mixed in with the lettuce, you know, like various clovers and buckwheat and just, you know, whatever's readily available in their area that grows well that's not going to create an issue for them. And they will also find that if they have more plants there that they'll have other things that they'll notice a difference. They don't need as much water. As the soil structure improves, they'll make more effective use of any rain that falls or irrigation water that they use. There'll be less evaporation because you've got all of the ground covered with something. You know, like it's when you see rows of lettuce, what the other thing that you see is lots and lots of bare ground between the rows. If there were plants growing in those areas as well, it's sort of hard to like to give. There's not like a one size fits all answer to that question. And some people grow cover crops between their lettuce crops and then just lay them down as mulch. I mean, that's one alternative, that at least you get some diversity between your crops of lettuce or something. But now, so cover crops is something like a multi-species cover crops is something that's been talked about a lot in the United States, and there's a lot of information about that. People can just, you know, Google that, and there's whole, like, managing multi-species covers and things. There's books written on that. But now the tendency is going like even more towards like companion planting, and that's where you plant other things in with the lettuce or in without whatever crop it may be, whether it's corn or soy or sunflowers or strawberries or whatever, just to plant other things in with them.
So then you've got multiple crops that you can actually sell, not just cover crops like clover.
When they're companion crops, it's not to sell the other things, unless you do something like what Gabe Brown does with his Chaos Garden, where he has probably 20 different kinds of vegetables and 20 cover crop species and 20 kinds of flowers or something like that. So he's got like 60 different kinds of seeds that he just all mixes up in his seed box and goes out and plants what he calls a Chaos Garden, and then sends people out to pick, you know, the silver beet and the corn and the squashes and everything like separately. It's a wonderful, wonderful system. I'm not quite sure how lettuce actually goes in that system. I think the thing is that our whole production system is designed on just having one thing and just, you know, going out and just picking lettuce, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's so counterproductive in terms of you've got so much bare soil, it's so inefficient in the way that it, there's so much water wasted in a system like that, and the soil deteriorates every year that you produce lettuce in that way or any other crop in that way. You'll have soil deterioration, and you get to the point where it costs so much to try and grow the plants in the first place that it's really not worth it. Or if you get something like, you know, like you're coming into an El Nino, theoretically there could be like a 1 in 100 year rainfall event, they're saying, for the United States this year, and you have like bare ground. It's just, you know, you would lose so much soil from those areas that, you know, it sets you back 20 or 30 years in terms of just losing that. You know, it's always that topsoil, the bit right at the top, that's got the most life in it and the most nutrients in it, and it's an incredible waste to see all that go down the rivers.
Whereas when you're growing a diversity of plants on that surface, the soil doesn't wash away.
No, that's right. And I mean, the second best thing would be to have a cover crop that was rolled down and then plant the lettuce into that. You know, there are, and again, there's information on the internet about no-till vegetable production and of growing cover crops and rolling them down and planting your vegetables into those.
In your experience, I mean, when I hear you talk, and I've heard a lot of people at this conference talk about the tremendous advantages of biodiversity and polycultures and not using chemicals and having these colonies of microorganisms in the soil. And once you get that, it seems like such a brilliantly good idea. And the, I mean, what you're doing is you're basically using a system of coevolution of all these different species that's happened over the last how many hundred million years. And the alternative, what's now weirdly called conventional, has evolved over the last 60 years and goes against nature. It's basically we're in continual war with nature. It seems like the craziest hubris. Do you see people making those changes back to a more natural system? Is that common now, or is it still a tiny percentage of people who are doing it?
I mean, what's really interesting is that when people have a jumble of plants all growing in together, like a beautiful chaos garden or a chaos crop or a crop with a putting flowers as underspecies under corn or underspecies under sunflowers or something like that, neighbours or friends or whoever, family, tend to go, oh, my God, what are you doing? I mean, it just looks so untidy. It, you know, because we're used to just seeing like straight rows of things or just one plant being there, whatever it is that you're growing. And you try to get, you know, just the right fertilizer and the right everything, the right amount of water and everything right for that one plant that you're growing. And that's what we've been trained to think, and that's what everybody kind of expects that farming's going to be. So when you go somewhere where the plants are just, you know, all kinds of different plants all thrown in together, and you know, the first time you see it, it's kind of a bit of a shock to the system. And then you work through that, because that's a commonly held belief that it, you know, needs to be all neat and tidy and in straight rows and only one kind of plant there. And then you realise that, hey, that's how Mother Nature has been doing it for millions of years. And now, or for me anyway, when I see just one thing growing there, I think, gee, that looks so unhealthy. You know, and that can only be detrimental for the farmer, for the soil, for the food that's being produced, and especially if I see bare ground, you know, it's just like, oh, if only people knew how much damage they're doing, because the ground will die, the soil will die. That is how you're going to lose all those microbial communities, having bare soil. And now I just think it looks absolutely fantastic when I see a whole lot of things all growing in together, because I know that the diversity above ground is going to be supporting diversity below ground. And, you know, how rich that's going to be and how much better for the people consuming the food that is going to be, as well as for the, you know, for everything else that lives on the planet, it is going to be better. Even something distantly removed like the ocean is going to be better off when our rivers aren't carrying all the pollutants that they carry at the moment, including soil from land where you've got, if you've got bare ground and you get heavy rain, you're going to get a lot of soil in the river that should not be there.
You showed pictures of a field that had basically been restored against the recommendations of the local community, who believed in having bare ground and just growing one crop. And these people grew lots of different things in a very lush, beautiful field that then they could graze sheep on. And I mean, for all the world, when you look at it, it was like looking at the difference between a sickly little child who never went outdoors and a healthy child that was running around. I mean, that's what those two fields look like to me. But in that case, these people's neighbors shunned them because it was socially unacceptable to grow that kind. I mean, the social barriers seem to be very, very great.
I think the social barrier is the greatest one. It's like everybody's doing something and they're all doing the same thing, so that's all okay. And then someone starts to do something different. I mean, we see this in all walks of life when somebody just decides they're going to do something different. It's you're just shunned by neighbours, shunned by family. We have research institutes still saying, you know, well, that doesn't work, or people saying that won't work here. I mean, it's funny, humans just have this, we like have this inbuilt resistance to change. And it's very unfortunate that that's how we seem to be hotwired. But the advantage of something like the Kavira conference is that it brings a whole lot of like-minded people together, people that all these people here are, you know, out there regenerating their landscapes. And at least when they come to an environment like this, they realise that they're all on the same page and they've got lots to talk about. And it just it empowers people to keep doing what they're doing. And as more and more people change, then it becomes okay to change. And one day, I am sure that it's not far away. We are going to look back at the way we have been currently, or the way we've been producing food over the last few decades, and wonder how we ever went down that track, to wonder how we could have, you know, how things could have ever got as bad as they are. It really is a very black time in food production at the moment. It's you couldn't devise a system that was worse for producing food than the one that we're currently using.
Well, and the one that we're currently using is backfiring really badly, because you get these, I think you called them super weeds, and the way you talked about these weeds that are resistant to any kind of weed killers, and they're very strong. You said, I think what you said was, they're takers, not givers. They don't want to be part of the community. They don't need to form relationships to survive. We know people like this. They're
maybe
not good community
people
members.
Like that might be the reason that we have the super weeds.
Yeah.
But when I was saying they were takers, not givers, I was talking about what happens underground in terms of plants channel carbon to the soil through their roots. Like they fix carbon from the atmosphere in photosynthesis, make sugars, and the sugars come out as exudates from the plant roots to support the microbes in the soil. But the weeds that have become super weeds, they don't do that. They don't give to the soil community, but they certainly take from the soil community in terms of taking the minerals and trace elements from it. So they've evolved mechanisms for being able to extract what they need from soil without supporting microbes. And that's the reason they've become super weeds. They can outcompete the crops. They can outcompete. So that this is one of the issues that we have when we've moved down this path of just having a monoculture, using lots of chemicals, not supporting life in the soil, that now we have plants that can survive without needing the life in the soil. We've got plants that actually have managed to overcome the toxins that we've applied to try and kill them, and now we cannot kill them with those toxins, and it doesn't matter how much poison you put on, you know. So, you know, poison isn't the answer. Toxic chemicals aren't the answer. Herbicides aren't the answer to weed issues. It's all about having a good, vibrant soil community that supports the diversity of plants. There's no space for weeds when you have lots of diversity there.
One of the things that happens when people convert to doing this kind of regenerative living agriculture with these live microbial colonies in the soil, the soil gets richer, the plants get more resilient, the water absorption is better, erosion is less, lots of good things. Carbon is sequestered, some carbon is sequestered permanently, positive impact on mitigating climate change. Then you've got something else, which is the people who are doing it make more money because they've got good yields and they're not spending all this money on pesticides and herbicides and all these other things. Does that provide an incentive for people who might be resistant to change?
Well, that's a really good point, because there's been a lot of talk for the last few years about, you know, how do we incentivize farmers to build carbon in their soil, mainly to mitigate emissions, like take carbon out of the atmosphere, put it in a stable form in soil. But we're realizing now that, and there's been, you know, so much backwards and forwards with regulators about how that might look and how you might pay farmers for carbon in their soil and how can you guarantee that they'll keep it there. And now we're saying, well, look, you know, there's going to be just so much red tape about this and surrounding this. There's probably going to be the middleman that makes all the money anyway, even if you came up with a price for carbon, like I'll just pick a number like $20 per tonne or something. You know, farmers will probably get 50 cents of that by the time all the other people in the chain got something. So why don't we just look at, well, as you were saying, if you're farming regeneratively, if you've reduced your chemical inputs, if your plants are now more water use efficient, if you don't need the fertilisers anymore, and so it goes. And you're providing it, you know, you're producing a nutritious product that oftentimes people are prepared to pay more for, then there is going to be a benefit for the farmer in terms of profit. And maybe that's all the incentive that they need to change. And I think when, you know, maybe all we need, really need to do is make people aware of the financial benefits of farming in this way. And that's sort of like the, that's pretty much the path that we're going down now, showing that this is a far more profitable way to farm. And it's more fun. I mean, who wants to be on a tractor spraying chemicals? I don't think there's really anybody that could enjoy doing that. It would be much better to be able to relax and just, you know, maybe notice that there's more birds coming to the farm, or that, you know, that the water's clean now, or knowing that you're producing healthy food, or even knowing that you're making more money. Just sit back and knowing that you're making more money. I think that whole quality of life for the person producing the food, and the fact that they can make more money more easily, that's going to be our selling point.
It does take a few years to make that transition.
Yes, it does take a little while to transition, and one of those reasons is that our soils are so degraded. Some of the essential key functional groups and microbes are missing, so it's not just going to suddenly be okay tomorrow. But one of the main groups of microbes that we have to get back are the free-living nitrogen-fixing bacteria, because nitrogen is so important to plant growth, and they're also important for sequestering carbon in a stable form.
One of the things that in what you're saying that it's so important to me is there's such a difference between the nitrogen cycle that happens naturally in the soil and in the plants, and the nitrogen that you pour onto it. And I think people get confused because it's like, oh, nitrogen, that's a good thing. And in one case, it makes these nitrates and it goes into the water and there's pollution and all kinds of problems and carcinogens. But the cycle you're talking about is the natural cycle, which pulls carbon out of the air and keeps it in the ground, which is a good thing.
There's a really big difference between inorganic nitrogen, which is the kind of nitrogen we apply as fertilizer, and organic nitrogen, which is nitrogen in the soil that's bound up with carbon, which is a really, really beneficial form to have. And obviously, if you have soils that are biologically active, they're able to transform the nitrogen into this organic form, which is beneficial. When nitrogen is in the inorganic form, that's when it causes problems. That's when it leaches through to groundwater. That's when it volatilizes and can go up into the air. Yeah, it can form nitrous oxide, which has 300 times the global warming potential of carbon dioxide. So, you know, people just think nitrogen is nitrogen is nitrogen. In actual fact, we've got to distinguish between the organic form of it and the inorganic form of it.
And ladies and gentlemen, if you didn't understand all that, it's okay, because at least as I hear it, the main point is farm according to the way nature has always done it instead of according to the way we are trying to manipulate it.
Yeah, well, that's a very important point, because, you know, because the nitrogen-fixing bacteria are so important, they're not just going to come back tomorrow. They take about 3 years for their numbers to build up to a population that's going to be really effective for fixing nitrogen. So if farmers have been using nitrogen, we recommend that they wean off it slowly over that three-year period. So they cut it back maybe 20% next year, and then another 50% of that the year after, and then, you know, another 50% of that, so that you're getting down to really, really small levels and tiny amounts of it won't be harmful. And at the same time as they're doing that, obviously thinking about diversity. If it's a pasture, you're thinking about your grazing management, and maybe there are some biological amendments that you can use. There's so much great stuff out there, like, you know, like compost extracts and seaweed extracts and all sorts of things. You can make your own, you know, vermi liquids, or like milk is a great fertilizer. Just so many biological products that are going to support microbes in the soil, support plants, support photosynthesis. So think about using those instead of your synthetics, and over that three-year period, you'll just see amazing changes in your soil and the quality of the food that you're producing.
Dr. Christine Jones is a research scientist in soil biology and ecology. Thank you so much for being with us.
And thank you.